Welcome into a Wednesday night edition of the Locked On Nets podcast. You are listening to the Locked On Nets podcast, part of the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day. My name is Gavin Shaw, and after 4 years covering the Phoenix Suns and two as a Pac-12 network broadcaster, I moved back to my native New York City to cover your Brooklyn Nets. You can follow me on Twitter at Gavin Shaw, the podcast at Locked On Nets. But the guy you really want to follow, my co-host, the lifelong Nets fan, at JMBass_Josh Bass. Josh, how you doing on this Wednesday evening?
Gavin, I'm doing well. I'm thinking about changing my Twitter handle because whenever you say it out loud, it really hits home that it's pretty poor on my end.
Yeah, was JM Bass taken? Is that why the underscore's in there?
That was taken, yeah.
Oh, that's too bad. That's ridiculous. Did you reach out to the guy and did you clarify that you're a public figure and you need the handle and you're willing to pay for it?
I have not. Maybe I'll consider using that tactic. You know, in my opinion, he got it first. Good on him. I'm going to let it slide. I'm not going to try to pester him or neg him to get that handle.
Come on. Come on. All right. That's fair. I was at the Nets Wizards game yesterday, and it was a good time. Obviously, a big time Nets win. Thanks to a friend of the show, Jeremy Caplet, for inviting me to go, and big thanks to his dad, Corey, for supplying the tickets and going with us and giving us some great seats. It was like center court, like row 9. It was really a joy because I've never really gotten to see those guys up close. And Josh, I don't know what you thought watching on TV, but my biggest takeaway watching all these guys in person were, one, Jared Allen is shaping up to be really, really good, and he's just light years ahead of where he thought I would be coming, where I thought he would be coming into the season at this point in the year. He's just so physical, athletic, and long around the basket. And going up against a guy like Marcin Gortat, who's lost a little weight but is still kind of a physical intimidator, he more than held his own. And for my money, clearly outplayed him when he was on the court.
Yeah, I thought Allen did a great job of showing you his potential, catching lobs around the rim. He's still a lot better when he can catch the ball up high and finish. He has some trouble when the guards pass him down low, and that's where he kind of loses a bit of his footwork and coordination. But he had two stellar blocks, one where he pinned a shot up against the glass, and that led to Damari Carroll finding RHJ for a dunk. And that was one of the biggest highlights of the night. Struggles a little bit on the defensive glass still, but then he's seen such an improvement over the season, as you mentioned. His free throw shooting even has looked good. It's up to 72% on the year, and I think he was under 60% at Texas. So to have that type of improvement is really remarkable.
Yeah, he just looked like fluid. His touch was really good, and his level of activity is just great. And you didn't, like, maybe I didn't watch enough of him at Texas, and like it escaped me. But like he didn't strike me as this guy. He struck me as like the type of guy who had like a lot of tools, but didn't necessarily have that engine yet. And for him to kind of develop that so early in his NBA career, I mean, it's a credit to Kenny Atkinson. It's a credit to the Nets' entire player development staff. But it's really a credit to Sean Marks and the talent he saw in Jared Allen. And I'm on record. I think you're on record with agreeing with me that we both think this is going to be one of the deepest drafts in memory. And I think when that's talked about over the years, at some point in the future, getting Allen at 22 is going to be one of those picks people talk about. And my other big thing with this game was that it was like shockingly fun to watch, considering like now that I'm looking at the stats, the Nets shot only 40% from the field and really ugly, 10 for 43 from three. Dinwiddie and Allen Crabb combining to go 4 for 25 between the two of them, and somehow it was still a joy. And Dinwiddie, despite that atrocious shooting, 1 for 11 from three, 4 for 14 from the field, he's just so smart. You could tell he's one of those guys, even when he's not hitting a shot, you could make a pretty coherent argument he was the MVP for the Nets in this game with just the way he controls pace and the way that he finds guys. I really liked watching him. And again, just this Nets team as a whole, that passing is so contagious. And again, not to take shots at our guy D'Lo, but when he's out of the equation, this team just moves the ball and they're a joy.
I don't know, Gavin. It sounds like you're hating a little bit on D'Lo.
So a little bit, yeah.
Direct any criticism to at Gavin Shaw.
Oh, thanks.
But just the point you made on Dinwiddie, I think at the start of the season when everyone would talk about his assist to turnover ratio, I would be like, oh, that's cute. You know, he doesn't really make a ton of high-level reads. But it's good that he doesn't turn the ball over. He's kind of a caretaker. But the last 10 or 12 games, he's really been making some high-level passes out of the pick and roll. Last night in particular, he was diming guys up. I've never been so impressed with a Nets point guard in my life just based on him exceeding expectations. I was pretty annoyed with his shot selection. 11 threes is unacceptable. I know he's been shooting the three ball great this year, but when you have a mismatch and guys like Jason Smith and Marcin Gortat are out on the perimeter guarding you, you have to at least try to get to the basket, and then you either have an open layup or be able to kick out the shooters. He was settling a lot, but I think that he got the message for next game, and even the 12 assists is still a highlight despite the poor shooting from three.
Yeah, no, 100%. And that's something I was kind of talking about on the Monday pod in the Mexico City. Like, I described it as like a LeBron-level read. I'm not calling him a LeBron-level passer, but it's like that type of play. Like, he had one in that game where he looked off the defense and then just threw it like 30 feet cross court on a dime to hit a guy wide open in the corner. And he's just starting to make plays like that. And his combination of vision and you have the perch that he has at 6'5", 6'6", whatever he's listed at, that really does make for a deadly passer. And I kind of wanted to save the stats a little bit because we can start getting into it now unless you have a lot more thoughts on this Nets-Wizards game. But we're going to kind of talk about what the lineup's going to look like when D'Angelo Russell comes back. But the statistics are just flat out astounding for Dinwiddie. You mentioned it was cute initially. Now it's just dominant and clearly sustainable. He leads the league in assist to turnover ratio. Fourth in the league in assists per 48 minutes. Longest streak in the league with 6-plus assists, which is a little bit arbitrary and feels like something the team PR staff is making up, but I'm going to go with it just because he's been that good of a passer. And most importantly, all of that adds up to the Nets being 13.5 points better on a per-game basis when Dinwiddie is on the floor. That's all pretty amazing.
Yeah, you know, it all sounds great to me. But it wasn't just Dinwiddie. There were so many great contributors last night. Basically, everyone besides Alan Crabb and Quincy Acey made an impact. Tyler Zeller, I thought, was excellent. His timing on rolls is really special, and I think that he makes the most out of his limited athleticism because he does know how to catch the ball in spots where he can kind of have an easy layup. Caris LeVert, we have to talk about his performance. 8 assists, knocked down 3 threes, still some sloppy turnovers, but you're encouraged with what you see out of him, and he's definitely building on his strong performance in Mexico City.
Yeah, 100% agree with you on both those guys. I want to, before I get into those two, I want to mention Quincy Acey, after watching him in person, basically confirmed what we've both seen on television.
He's a nice guy.
Yeah, sure. He's a sweetheart. And he, what was I going to say? He, like, I know I was a little bit more bullish on him than you early in the year, and I'm ready to concede that argument. He's, like, one of the worst rotation players in the NBA. He was 4 rebounds, 2 missed shots, and a foul away from putting up a 17 trillion, with, if anyone isn't familiar with the famous Mark Titus dub stat, that's no statistics across 9 categories. So 17 minutes, 2 missed shots, 4 rebounds, 1 foul. That's, I think if you replace him with, and we'll get to that, talking about Julius Okafor potentially playing, if you replace him with like a league average power forward in those minutes, the Nets win this game by 10, maybe, and I'd love to see what they do the rest of the year. That's just such a weak spot.
Yeah, I mean, league average power forward, would you think of someone maybe like a Trevor Booker type?
Like Mark, yeah, sure, or like a Markieff Morris. But yeah, Trevor Booker is a good example of that. And oh, by the way, I was watching a Sixers T-Wolves highlights. He looks good in his new uniform.
I miss him so much already.
He set up Embiid pretty nicely on one play.
To break your heart. When he first shaved his head this year, it was kind of a shock to me, but now it's growing back, and it's like the book that I'm used to.
Yeah, it's awesome to see, and he's still rocking the headband, which is pretty cool. Yeah, Karis, you said it, continued to build on his really strong play in Mexico City. I say this every single podcast, so I apologize, but it's just amazing how confident he is with the ball in his hand versus earlier in the year when he was the third or fourth option when he was on the floor. Now that he gets to attack game in and game out, he really does like make it look easy And like part of that is like the Nets, like we could go through it at some point if you want. Like on the whole, they haven't had like the hardest competition in terms of point guards. But then you look at that Thunder game and he flat out outplayed Russell Westbrook about 5 days ago. So you can't even totally pin it on that. He's been playing so well and so efficiently, and it's stunning to see. Because, again, I wanted to say this for the Bash D'Lo segment, but I'll get into it a little bit. When D'Lo was healthy and on the floor with Karis, when D'Lo was healthy in those games, Karis was shooting 19% from the field, 24% from three, 61% from the charity stripe. That's about the least efficient shooting numbers. I mean, like, excuse guys like Tony Allen and Andre Roberson, maybe. The least efficient shooting numbers from a steady rotation guy I've ever seen. Since then, he's at 48% from the field, 36% from three, 71% from the line. So a completely different player. And I don't know, Josh, maybe you can think of a good example. I've almost never seen that a guy shooting that way for the first like 12 to 15 games of the season and then suddenly doubling all of his, or at least doubling his three-point percentage and doubling his field goal percentage. That's absolutely insane. And I don't know how sustainable it is, but I'm loving the ride right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to happen when Lonzo starts shooting 50% from three, because then he'll be doubling his percentages.
Right? Oh, wow. That's just mean. He did go off against the Knicks the other night. That's an accomplishment, right?
What do you have, like 15 points?
He had like 16 points.
Yeah, he had a good first half and then really couldn't get anything going.
Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anything else in this game. Carroll was good. I feel like with Carroll, it's starting to be like if he has like an inch from three, like you feel like it's going in, like, and I know he's, like, maybe the numbers don't back him up as, like, a great shooter this year, but when he's, like, feeling confident and he starts really extending that follow-through, he's just a notch below Allen Crabbe and Joe Harris in terms of shooting the basketball.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I do think that Damari's been a great addition, and I'm very surprised by his three-point ability. Just comparing him to Crabbe, though, who is abysmal last night, just... He was just shooting threes every time he touched the ball, and it felt like he was holding on to the button too long, honestly, if he was a 2K player. It was so frustrating to watch. I don't know. Credit to him for hitting that big three to put the Nets up two at the end of the game, and also a good play call by Kenny Atkinson. But I'm pretty frustrated with Crabbe, as I have been the whole season, that he doesn't really provide a lot of value. He had one very nice pass out of the pick and roll. Wow. Oh, I just saw a Dwight Howard play where he went coast to coast, and that's going to be on House Highlights and all over Twitter. So I definitely recommend checking that out. Sorry.
Go ahead.
Wow. That's really incredible. But yeah, Crabbe, he needs to be more consistent adding value, because you do see those flashes where he'll make a nice defensive play or dime a guy up or have a good take to the basket. But he's too reliant on a 3-point shot. And obviously that's going to be his bread and butter. It always will be. But to make $70 million over your contract, make $18 million a year, you have to do other things besides shoot three, because you're going to have off nights like he did last night.
Yeah, and before we wrap up this Zards recap, I want to throw a quick shout out to the Nets defensively. They're continuing not a long pattern, but a 2 out of 3 game pattern of forcing two of the best guards in the NBA into really poor shooting performances, despite their high raw numbers. A couple nights after, I think Westbrook went like 10 for 27 against the Nets, they held Beal to 11 for 33 from the floor and 0 for 7 from three-point range, though he did have that one essentially called back at the end of the game after the 5-second violation. But yeah, 28 points, 4 assists for Bradley Beal. But again, took him 33 shots, only made 11 of them. So,
yeah, the Nets did a pretty good job on Beal. I'll give them credit for that. Dinwiddie was excellent contesting shots, and so was Jared Allen when he was switched on to Beal in the pick and roll. But Beal was also just terrible in terms of missing so many open shots that he normally hits.
Yeah, I might have missed that.
Especially in the first half, 4 or 5 shots that were just wide open. And I was shocked when he was missing them, because he's normally lights out on that.
Yeah, I think it might be like the load is getting to him a little bit. Luckily, he got John Wall back tonight, and the Wizards got a win. Anyways, Nets hold the Wizards to 40% from the field, 18% from three-point range, and they get 103-98 victory over the Washington Wizards. All right, so Josh, I'm going to let you take the lead on this one, because you suggested talking about it. I think it's a great idea. I think it's a great time to talk about it on a night we don't have a game. The potential logjam when D'Angelo Russell comes back, your idea, you take the floor. What do you think about it?
Yeah. So right now, Spencer Dinwiddie has been in, I guess, a little bit of trade talks. I don't see any way the Nets give him up. He's way too valuable. Caris LeVert's really starting to burgeon into a very good young player, especially on the offensive end. He needs ball handling responsibilities. Allen Crabbe, getting paid a lot of money, whether we like it or not. He's on the team. And then D'Angelo Russell, he was excellent before he went down. Didn't necessarily translate into team wins, but on an individual basis, he definitely improved a lot from his time for the Lakers. And all four of those guys need playing time, and they need time with the ball in their hands. So it presents a little bit of a logjam, especially when you consider Joe Harris, who's been a very good role player for the Nets this year. How is that minutes load going to be structured? I think that D'Lo and Dinwiddie have to start together. I would move Crabbe to the three, actually. And we spoke about how the Nets' weakest rotation spot is definitely that backup four, with Quincy AC being an abomination. So if we split up RHJ and Damari and move one of them to the bench, then the other could play a ton of minutes at the backup four, and obviously they're going to overlap for a little bit. But it does solve that problem. Gavin, am I a genius, or do you see any flaws in my brilliant solution?
I like that idea, but can I suggest a hot take that, in my mind, doubles as a better one?
No, you can't.
Okay, all right, then that'll wrap up our show. All right, now, okay, we're going to talk about it. All right, very quickly. What do you think about D'Angelo Russell coming off the bench? And before you yell me down, let me just make a quick case here. I mentioned Caris LeVert's numbers with D'Lo and without him, but I'll throw them out there one more time. 19% from the field, 24% from three, 61% from the charity stripe, 48% from the field, 36% from three, 71%. Now that's totally unfair to pin that all on D'Lo. The bigger one, the all-inclusive one, D'Angelo Russell's offensive success not translating to team offensive success. With D'Lo on the floor, the team's offensive rating this year, 100.5. With D'Lo off the floor, the team's offensive rating this year, 106.3. That from Liam Gallagher over at Nothing But Nets. So shout out to him for supplying some cool stats. But all that added up to me, well, basically, that kind of equates with the eye test. And, like, I think what we were both seeing, where, like, guys just look a lot more comfortable without D'Angelo Russell. And there's a reason that when you lose a guy that was objectively, like, or at least, I don't know, I guess, like, in terms of scoring, the Nets' best player, and they've gotten better since they've lost him, it is a little bit of Ewing theory, but it's all backed up by the stats on the court. And I think what we both saw. And the only question is, like, how tenable is it to do that from a relations perspective? Like, D'Angelo Russell's only 21, so theoretically he'd be okay with coming off the bench, and, like, that's kind of what young guys have to do. But this is also the guy who's been, like, either the best or second-best guy on the team his whole career and was the team's alpha dog and clear number one option before he left, and for him to lose that spot because of a knee injury is kind of iffy, but in my mind, Spencer Dinwiddie is just, at this point in his career, so clearly better than him that I think if you want to do right by the team, you have to start Dinwiddie. And I don't know, I don't think D'Lo is going to be exceptionally good off the ball. I think he's a sieve on defense at this point. And I think they'd be better off with him being kind of a scoring guy off the bench. And if you think you can manage it, maybe finish the game with both of them on the floor. What do you think about that, Josh? Presumably you're going to say I'm insane.
Yeah, I mean, you took the words right out of my mouth.
Oh, good. Okay.
Come on. Listen, first of all, D'Angelo Russell is the future of this team.
I agree with that.
And obviously, listen, when Jeremy Lin first went down, D'Angelo Russell said, I'm going to have to do everything by myself. I have to carry this team of no-names to a somewhat respectable record. Now he's been sitting on the bench for the last 15 games or so, and he sees, listen, we're winning without me. All Nets fans pray to the altar of Spencer Dinwiddie now, and he's seen the effect that Dinwiddie has. So when he does come back in the starting lineup, if he's playing alongside Dinwiddie, he's going to be more comfortable playing off the ball. He'll say, listen, I know that we have another capable point guard and playmaker playing alongside with me. And remember, the plan when D'Angelo Russell got here was for him to play alongside Jeremy Lin and for them both to take playmaking duties off of each other and for D'Angelo Russell to be used pretty frequently as a spot-up shooter and someone that could receive the fruits of Jeremy Lin's labor from him driving to the basket and kicking it out to D'Lo for open lanes or open threes. And now Dinwiddie's going to be able to do that, so I don't think it's going to be a problem. I think that Russell can be more than willing to offload playmaking responsibility now that he's seen the team stay afloat without him. And Caris LeVert's going to stay in his role, so that's going to be smooth. And I think that D'Lo and Dinwiddie can play well together, and it's going to give the Nets a lot of size in the backcourt.
Josh, I want to finish up this conversation on D'Angelo Russell, but first I want to tell our listeners about my favorite daily fantasy site, Draft. Fantasy sports fans, if you weren't already, listen up. Did you know that your chances of winning on Draft are 80% better than on salary cap sites? That's why Draft is my favorite fantasy site. No more getting crushed by the pros. And it's not just me. More than 1 million people that have already downloaded Draft are enjoying it too. Play in a real live NBA draft right now. Be done in under 5 minutes and get paid out the next day. Drafts are filling every second, so you can join whenever you want. All new players get a free entry into a real money draft when you make your first deposit, but you have to use my promo code LONETS. That's LONETS. That's right. Play in a real money draft for free just by using my promo code LONETS. But it gets even better. Draft is so sure you'll love it that they're offering Locked On Nets listeners a money-back guarantee up to $100. That's substantial. Just search Draft in your app store or go to draft.com and come play free right now with our promo code LONETS. All right, Josh, I hear your point. I think long-term, they're going to need to figure out a way to play D'Angelo Russell and Spencer Dinwiddie together, because if what Dinwiddie's been doing is at all sustainable, and I think at this point I'm coming pretty close to locking it in that it is, I think these guys are the two kind of foundational pieces of this team. Jeremy Lin obviously is in that conversation if he can come back healthy and just as effective as he was at the end of last year. But when you take that into account, I think what you're missing on your end is you're underestimating D'Angelo Russell's ego. I'm not saying he's a dumb guy by any means. I think having heard him talk, he's a pretty darn intelligent guy. And I think intellectually, he's going to get what you're saying and see how well this team is playing with Dinwiddie and want to keep that going. I think as a guy on the court, he's proven himself totally incapable of doing that throughout his career. He hasn't had a lot of opportunity to do that, so there is a window there, and maybe that's why you did make a compelling case to start him initially with Dinwiddie, but I'll just say I have my doubts about those two playing together and whether D'Lo's really willing to consistently give up touching the basketball. And it wasn't even that he isolated that much. It was just how long he had the ball in his hands. In terms of average touches per game, he was in the top 25 in the entire league, and a little bit of that was probably the Nets' pace, but I think that's reflective of what we saw, and I think you'd agree with me, he did dominate the ball at points, and I just don't know if he's ready to give that up.
No, I do agree with you, but at the same time, when you have two guys that are clearly either one the most talented, D'Angelo Russell, and the other probably the flat-out best right now, Spencer Dinwiddie, players on the team, you have to at least try them together and see how it works. I mean, listen, to go back to the Blazers, if you have Damian Lillard and CJ McCollum, you're going to try them out together before you decide to move off of it. You have to at least give it a shot, see how they play alongside each other, see how they interact as starters, and then if it doesn't work, we can figure it out from there. But it's not going to go well if D'Angelo Russell immediately moves to the bench, or Spencer Dinwiddie moves to the bench after playing so well running the ship, because then there could be some sort of resentment there. You have to at least keep all your options open at the start, and that means starting D'Lo and Dinwiddie together, and then I guess having Crab play as the three and then figuring it out from there. And also, my plan eliminates your weakest rotation player in Quincy Adosu, who I don't know how much more I can take with the guy.
Yeah, I'm with that. And then I guess you have Caris LeVert as your point guard off the bench. So, Josh, one more time. I guess my best version of that starting lineup then would be D'Angelo Russell, Spencer Dinwiddie. With Dinwiddie, for my money, I think he's earned the right to be the primary point guard in that scenario. Like, I know you could have, like, both guys bring it up, stagger their minutes a little bit, too.
Just to clarify, my plan means that Dinwiddie and D'Lo are, one of them's going to be on the floor at all times, going back to, like, a KD and Russ scenario, where you have one of your primary initiators always on the court.
Well, no, but wasn't the issue that they weren't played together? The comparison I'd make is James Harden.
They should have been.
Sure. But I'll say the perfect version of that exists right now. James Harden and Chris Paul, where they start together, they finish the game together, but then they get like long stretches apart in the middle of the game, and which allows both those guys to be at their absolute best. And like obviously, this is a less talented version of that duo, but I like the idea of Dinwiddie as the Chris Paul, D'Lo as the James Harden, and those two guys splitting minutes in a similar way. And I think Houston has shown that that can be very, very effective. All right, and then you have Caris LeVert getting some minutes in that backup point guard spot, as we already mentioned. RHJ, Carroll, and who did you have Zeller starting at the five?
Yeah, Zeller is going to start.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Coming off the bench, Okafor, whenever they feel he's ready, he'll hop in there. Mozgov will be banished back to Siberia.
That's perfect. I'll say this. I think right now I agree with that. I think Zeller and Dinwiddie have really developed a nice chemistry, and Zeller just fits in really cleanly with that starting unit. But I'll make a prediction by the end of the year, and maybe it'll just be because the Nets want to try it out. I have a feeling Jared Allen is going to start some games with that group, and I'd like to see that if he continues on his current trajectory.
Well, I don't think that's a hot take at all. That's pretty lukewarm.
Well, did I describe it as a hot?
Come on, everyone knows he'll be starting by
then. Okay, no, I'm falling into a pattern. I'm describing everything as a hot take. That's my fault. All right, I do want to talk about Jahlil Okafor, who didn't play a minute in his semi-official Nets debut. But before I do, I wanted to give a quick clarification on our awards podcast. So we were initially going to record it tonight. I got lazy, didn't want to record two. Plus, it is a trimester award, and once the Nets have played 26 games, mathematically, that's a little bit more representative of or 27 games rather. That's mathematically a little bit more representative of a trimester, because that'll be just one game off, or I guess a third of a game off of being a third through the season. So
yeah, I thought we're gonna do it. Obviously, during the 28th game, about 4 minutes in the second quarter, so we can really make sure it's 27.33.
Okay, yeah, that's true. I'm sorry, that's exactly how we're going to do it. Yeah, so we want to be mathematically correct, so we are going to record that one Friday, put it out Friday night, and let you guys enjoy that over the weekend, because we were really excited to get this one out. So we thank you for bearing with us on that point, and we're both really excited to do it. All right, Josh, let's get into it. Jahlil Okafor. We did a whole podcast breaking down our immediate reactions to his arrival in Brooklyn, but not getting a minute that first game. I just kind of took it as he's not ready to play in this scheme necessarily, even though he had a few days while they were in Mexico City to start learning it. What do you kind of expect for them incorporating him into the rotation? How many minutes do you think he's going to play over the next couple of games?
Yeah, they're going to have to ease him along slowly. Obviously, he's learning the system. But on another note, I mean, the guy hasn't played this year. He was injured most of last year, various nagging injuries with the 76ers, and he's only played 25 total minutes this year. So he could be working out as much as he wants off the court, but until you actually get in the game, you're not going to be in game shape. So it's been said that that he might play against the Knicks. He might not. Obviously, if it's a blowout, he'll get minutes along with Stauskas. But
Stauskas!
Yeah. Big soft Castillo. But anyway, if he might get 10 minutes next game, who knows? It's going to be up to Kenny Atkinson. If not Thursday's game, he will probably get in Friday, get some time. But he's not going to be playing more than 15 minutes a night until I really think after the All-Star break, and then maybe they'll ramp him up. But again, depending on how he plays. Jared Allen is the center of the future for this Nets team. I think he's a lot of promise. The team seems really high on him. And as we spoke about earlier in the episode, his improvement just in 25 games so far has been remarkable. And if he can keep up something even close to that trajectory, then he's going to be a very good starter in this league, possible an all-star caliber player. So, you know, Jahlil Okafor doesn't have any expectations. He's not on the Sixers anymore. The Nets weren't the team that drafted him with the third overall pick. So if he can come in and be a good backup center, I'm more than happy with that.
Yeah, so what do you you kind of hinted at it there, but what do you see out of him long-term for this Nets team in terms of the minute distributions at that center spot? Because obviously you don't really want Jared Allen losing anything with how well he's been playing. We just spent like 5 minutes talking about how well Zeller fits in with the starters. You don't really want him losing anything. Obviously, he's going to take Mozgov's minutes, but recently that's only been like 8 minutes a game at most, maybe even less some games. Like, he'll only come in for like one quick rotation and then go right out. Do you see him being a guy who hits 20 minutes a game with maybe Allen or Zeller playing some power forward and the Nets going back to bully ball? Because that would seem to kind of take away like the Nets' like biggest advantage, and I don't know if any of those bigs are good enough to justify playing like that. But if you don't play Zeller more than 10 minutes a game, like how do you know if you want to keep him after this year? Like that seems like such a tough situation for me, and maybe the long-term solution is just kicking Zeller out of the rotation, getting a little bit worse in the short term so you can see what you have in your two greatest assets at that spot. I just gave you a lot of different options. How do you think that works itself out?
Yeah, you know, it's a tough question because you're looking at all three of these centers, Okafor, Zeller, and Jared Allen, and you're trying to think, can any two of these guys play with each other? And I'm really not sure, especially when you have Rondae Hollis-Jefferson, who's been much improved this year, but he can't play the three offensively because that's really going to clog the offense. So he's locked in at the four for his 25, 28 minutes a night. I guess you could technically play maybe Allen and Okafor together, Allen and Zeller, because Allen does provide that vertical spacing, and Zeller is a decent mid-range shooter. But, you know, it's tough. I think that by the end of the season, maybe we'll get some, like, Allen 20 minutes a night center, and then Okafor and Zeller splitting the other 14 apiece. But, you know, Zeller could come down to earth and really struggle. Okafor could exceed expectations and take some of those minutes. And also, all three of these guys have had injury problems in the past. Jared Allen's already been injured this season. So if one of them goes down, then we'll get to have an extended look at the other two and see what happens. And as the Nets know, with their point guard situation, injuries can pile up. So there's never a problem with having too many solid players at one position.
Yeah, I think that's a great take on it, and a good place to kind of wrap up this podcast, because we talk about how crazy the Nets' point guard rotation is going to be with D'Lo back. Could you imagine if Jeremy Lin had stayed healthy the whole season, what it would look like? I mean, I just feel like Caris LeVert never would have totally gotten a rhythm, and the Nets never would have fully known what they had in Spencer Dinwiddie. It would have been a different offense, and they would have been playing two of these guys at a time, so there would have been a little bit more room, but it's just so weird to think about how different it could have been.
I can't imagine a pre-Dinwiddie world.
Yeah. All right, Josh, I've been told we need to describe this segment a little bit more, because like some of our new listeners are like kind of weirded out when we do it, even though they love it. What grinds my gears? We were doing it every single episode during the off season. I think we've toned it back to once a week because Josh is working like 60 hours a week now. And I don't know if you can take the stress of reliving your worst memories week after week after, or day after day after day. So we're limiting it to once a week to take some of the pressure off of you and let you really gather your thoughts on what minuscule thing in your life is annoying you most at the times of our recording. So Josh, with that preface, what is grinding your gears this week?
Yeah, just a quick aside. I'm spending all those hours at work in Midtown Manhattan, so you can imagine how many topics I have to complain about, and how fruitful that area is for things that grind my gears. Okay, moving on to what actually grinds my gears. This week, or last week rather, LeVar Ball pulled LiAngelo Ball from UCLA, and LiAngelo, along with his brother Melo Ball, have signed with a team in Lithuania. And listen, Melo Ball is 16 years old, LiAngelo Ball is 18 years old. These kids are now being pulled from America to go to Lithuania, not even the capital of Lithuania, which I don't even know what that is, but the middle of nowhere.
Spitestag.
Their coach doesn't speak English.
I'm just kidding. I don't know what it is. Go ahead.
I don't even know what Lithuanian cuisine is like. I'm sure that the Ball brothers would prefer more of the California food. And it doesn't feel right to me that these kids are pulled away from their friends, girlfriends, what have you, family, and now they have to live in Lithuania to play basketball.
Yeah, it's pretty bad.
You know what? Like, I'm sure LaMelo Ball, once he got pulled from school, he's like, you know what? This is great. Like, I can just hang out all day, just shoot around. I don't have to go to class, do anything. I can still see my friends. And now he didn't choose to go to Lithuania. I'm a huge LeVar fan in general, but this just seems like a bridge too far. To take a 16-year-old kid who's used to being in L.A., has all the pomp and circumstance of being one of the three Ball brothers, part of their own shoe company, and now he's just plopped in the middle of Lithuania, which I'm sure he couldn't have even found on a map 1 week ago at this time.
Josh, are you forgetting that LaMelo is going to be reunited with his longtime pen pal Yiktor in Lithuania?
Shout out to Yichter.
former Waffles and Dinge employee.
That's actually Belgium instead of... I mean, if they were in Belgium, it's a much better place to...
I think there are Lithuanian Yichters and Belgian Yichters, but we'll leave that aside for now. Yeah, I agree with you. I think it's kind of comically insane just because that's like kind of like everything LeVar Ball does, but it is definitely like a little bit insane. And like, I get like the theory behind it, like even though I think he's delusional, if he thinks LiAngelo Ball, who's an NBA player, is that's been reiterated by like everyone even loosely associated with the NBA draft that he is not. Like, I thought that was so funny, like the rush from every single reporter to say like, oh, talk to this GM or talk to these four scouts, and they all said LiAngelo Ball is not on their draft list. And even if he had averaged 40 points a game this year at UCLA, he was not on their draft list. Like, I don't know. I'm so torn on it because like the like whole like stealing thing in China was so ridiculous and just painted him as like kind of a dick. But like at the same time, like the kid, like specifically LiAngelo right now is who I'm talking about. He like allegedly had like a 4.0 GPA in high school. And if he's like a smart kid, like even if he's like not going to have a future in professional basketball, and it seemed like his best case scenario is playing in China or like a lower level league in Europe, like he's going to do right now, let him get 4 years of a free UCLA education. That's extraordinarily valuable. It's an opportunity like people around the country would kill themselves for. And like, I don't want to get on like my high horse defending the NCAA because like I think all college basketball and football players, or at least the ones that play, should be getting paid. And now he's going to get paid to play ball. So I understand it from that perspective. But I don't know. I can't see how giving that up is going to be good for him long term.
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. LeVar just robbed him of 4 years of partying at UCLA. And if you want to take him out of school, that's fine. I'm sure he was happy. No drug tests anymore. He can smoke as much weed as he wants to.
Jesus.
But now you have to bring him into Lithuania. He's only going to get paid $1,000 a month, maybe. It's just ridiculous. I don't know. I feel bad for these kids, to be honest. I never did. I thought LeVar was always a good dad, and he was just kind of his message of wanting his kids to all play together and be together, I thought was very admirable. But seeing just him ship his kids off to Lithuania is a bridge too far for me.
Yeah, I don't know. I think this ends with LaMelo coming. I don't know. He's like, could LaMelo even...
No eligibility now.
Well, I know he doesn't have college eligibility, but could he come back and play like high school basketball if he hates it? I don't know how that works.
I guess so, but he's in his junior year now. I think by the time everything gets sorted out, he would have to re-enroll at Chino Hills. I mean, he could go into the G League 2 years from now. I mean, he's a legit prospect, so he has a future. I mean, LiAngelo, listen, this guy could have just gotten his education at UCLA, become an agent for his two brothers like Porzingis' brother did, and his life would be set for eternity.
Yeah.
I don't know. It's just the whole thing rubs me the wrong way, and I have a feeling that a month or two from now, the Ball brothers will be back in the States, scarred from their experience in Lithuania. And listen, no shots against Lithuania. I haven't been there. If they want to, the government wants to bring me out for a free trip, I'm more than willing. And I'd love to visit one day.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it's going to be a culture shock for these two teenagers.
All right. I'm going to ask David to reach out for us and see if we can get you a credential to all of the Ball's games. And you could be the Woj of the Lithuania League. All right. Anyways, we're slightly over 40 minutes, so good time to wrap this up. Josh, I appreciate you tolerating me for this long. And again, we will be back on Friday with the Nets first trimester awards and talking about the Knicks-Nets game. So expect it to be a contentious podcast between me and Josh. That is it for now. Peace out.